From its earliest beginnings in the Rue Morgue, via characters who've become household names like Sherlock Holmes, Miss Marple and Morse, crime fiction has always been a publishing phenomenon. Kate London is a rising star in the firmament of British crime writers. She first appeared on the show back in January to tell us about her critically acclaimed debut, Post-Mortem. It's a gripping, poignant novel in which she draws on her service in the Met to produce a perfect blend of police procedural and character-led crime thriller. During that interview, she let slip some clues about her eagerly anticipated sequel. So, when Death Message was published earlier this week, simultaneously in print and audio, I decided it was time to bring her back in for further questioning. But first, I needed some evidence. So here, courtesy of Whole Story Audiobooks, is Exhibit A, a sample taken from the opening scene of Death Message.
The Great Storm of 1987 was the before and after of Claire Mills's life. More than 20 years later, she still woke in the middle of the night with a sudden ice-cold alarm that had her sitting up and seeing with luminous clarity those uprooted trees and crushed vehicles. The terror in her heart in the lonely hours of the morning was always the same, that the smaller traces of disaster in her life that she had chosen to ignore for so long had, on the morning after the storm, been emphatically written on the landscape, crying out for her to notice them at last. Among the many, many reproaches she made to herself was this one. She had failed to pay attention to portents. She had known her daughter had secrets. She had known, too, that her husband was having an affair. But whenever she had thought of his all-too-obvious infidelity, and she admitted to herself now that she had strived not to think of it, her sideways-glancing decision had always been to ignore it. It would blow over. His affair had perhaps not been the cause of what happened, but it was another symptom of her willful somnambulism. She had been too attached to her becalmed life. She had kept a tidy house. She had loved her central heating and fitted carpets, the newly installed Everest windows. When daylight came, it offered the consolations of reason. The storm had, perhaps, facilitated in some way what followed, but it had surely been no supernatural harbinger. Still, each year, whenever the days shortened into autumn, she faced alone her belief that her own willful blindness had brought such disaster on her. Those trees, those upturned roots.
Kate London, thank you very much for joining me in the Read On Air studio again.
It's a pleasure.
I get the impression that you chose the title Death Message equally deliberately as you chose Post-Mortem. Could you tell us exactly what the title Death Message refers to?
Well, in police talk, death message is when you have to tell the next of kin that somebody has died. It's usually a memorable experience to go to somebody's house and tell them that unexpectedly somebody they love has died. And I think the sort of pun, as there was a pun on Post-Mortem, is I suppose it's a book about living for the two main protagonists, Sarah and Lizzie.
And that image of the trees uprooted by violence by the storm in 1987 that the book starts with is one that resonates throughout the book. The fact that the detectives are investigating skeletal remains that have been unearthed by violent acts. That and I think you at one point say, you know, Sarah Collins sees her job as giving the anonymous victims of London their importance back.
I think she says that she had thought that she could represent small people against the sort of tide of indifference, and she's standing by the Thames when she thinks this, and that after the experience of Post-Mortem that she feels less confident of that, shaken. And I think that the two characters, Lizzie and Collins, are both uprooted by what's happened in the novel before. So you have the turned earth after the storm, and the fact that a girl is missing and that family is constantly uprooted and never able to settle, but also that the two main protagonists are in a similar state.
Yes, that they actually have to assume the grief of the friends and relatives of the missing or murdered victims that they're looking into.
Yes, and I think you see with Lizzie that she's resistant, that she doesn't want to get involved in the people that she's tasked with investigating and so on. She resists it, but she becomes, you know, more and more involved. So I suppose it's quite a redemptive novel in a way for the two female protagonists.
And I think, I mean, I certainly hadn't realised that murder investigation teams investigate two cases concurrently, that there's a cold case and an active case. Is that standard procedure within the Met?
Yes, major investigation teams, MIT teams, will have any number of investigations running at any particular time. They have a period, which is in the book, which was when they're on call for 7 days, where they will respond to live incidents. So somebody who's likely to die, a high-risk missing person, or a murder, or indeed a manslaughter. But then they will also have ongoing cases, and they will have cold case reviews, historic cases that come back up, that they will review the evidence. And I think one of the brilliant things is that an undetected murder isn't closed in the Met. It's looked at on a regular basis in case there are leads that can lead to detecting it.
So I know that you don't take actual cases and write about them, but the reinvestigation of somebody who disappeared in 1987 and whose body has never been found is something perfectly plausible for a MIT team to be looking into.
Yes, absolutely. A case like that would be reviewed if the person was believed to have come to harm. And if there was any new evidence, resources would be put into it. And if you Google cold cases or historic cases, you will find that the Met does get detections for them, and that they're always a cause for celebration, that even though they often bring bad news and they turn the earth, as it were, of the experiences of the next of kin, at the same time, they do bring resolution for people.
Yes, I thought you handled that very sensitively and very thought-provokingly, that I know one of the detectives asked herself, well, what would we be wishing for if this girl were still to be alive? You know, she would have been imprisoned, she would have had awful things done to her. Maybe it's better actually to turn up a dead body so that people can move on.
Well, I don't think I say quite that, but I think one of the things about people who are missing is that the families worry so very much where they are and what's happening to them, and that there's something desperate about that open question. And so resolution is helpful. I don't think it's better for people to be dead, but I think a resolution is really important for people, and it's very desperate for people not to know what's happened.
And as you said, both your detectives are moving on from post-mortem, and that's in very stark contrast to the mother of the missing girl who is caught in this kind of stasis. But both your detectives are just moving on to the next traumatic incident. You say there's a redemption at the end of the novel, but both of them have been put through the ringer again. You don't pull any punches about how traumatic and difficult policing in 21st century London can be.
Well, it's interesting because the book's just been serialised, and a lot of the... I've had brilliant readership who've been incredibly responsive and warm and involved, but one of the things they've talked about is how hard policing is. But I think that is partly a product of this particular book, where these two women are really in a state of trying to resolve how they feel about their job and whether they can continue to do their job after the experiences of the last book. And I think that when you do it, it isn't like that all the time. And also there's an enormous joy and pleasure in policing, which probably doesn't come across in this book because that isn't what this book's about. But there's an enormous satisfaction in delivering justice for people.
It's certainly something that I think comes out in the squad room humour that you have, such as when the team gather together to investigate the current murder.
The duty inspector had rounded up CID from all over the nick, and the drinks machine shuddered loudly as it dispensed Coke and Red Bull. Ash had celebrated the news by bringing the biscuit tin from the office to the canteen, and everyone was digging in, the tin rapidly emptying.
"I'm a rebel, me,"
he said in a fake northern accent. "Can't wait to see the DI's face in the morning when all the biscuits have gone. Do you think she'll put a crime report on?" An officer, in the act of stuffing two biscuits in his mouth at the same time, said,
"You're fine, mate. No witnesses."
The duty inspector walked briskly into the canteen and sat at one of the tables.
"When you're ready."
They gathered round, mostly standing. She handed out the hastily printed briefing sheets.
"With the station Grapevine fully operational, I expect most of you will already know what this is about."
Lizzie was staring at the briefing. At the top was a custody image of a white male, round head, short cropped hair, QPR shirt. It was the most recent image, taken the last time he'd been nicked. She looked down the page and saw the name of the victim. She pulled out a chair and sat down. Ash was looking in her direction, but she avoided him, gazing steadfastly at the briefing sheet. Inspector Redwood was still talking.
"As a woman who served in the Metropolitan Police for several years, do you think that women bring a different perspective to detection?"
"What I'd say more is that you need a mix of people. It isn't necessarily to do with whether they're male or female, but different experiences, different attitudes. You know, there's the guy who can sit there with the spreadsheet and just concentrate on the spreadsheet all day, and that is very important detective work, but it isn't for everybody. And then there's the guy who can go along and talk to the guy who's fencing stolen goods and persuade him to talk to him. And again, that's a different skill. Not everybody's going to have that skill. And there's the person who can go, not necessarily a woman. I went with a brilliant man in his 50s once to deliver a death message, and he was so fantastic at being there and listening and saying the right thing and not saying too much. So I think it's more that you really need a big range of personalities and people."
Clearly, the delivering of death messages must have affected you quite deeply. I mean, you certainly bring the detective's eye for detail to the minutiae of how relatives react and how they slowly crumple or they slowly put up walls and how it's not a static state.
Yes, and everybody's different and everyone is surprising. You know, it isn't what you expected. It isn't the same every time. Yes, they stay with you, definitely.
I think one of the fascinating aspects of the book is having the two female protagonists.
And of course, Fat Elaine now.
And Fat Elaine, who's a wonderful character and and coaxed away from the biscuit tin, which I think is just terrific. But you give the three, two or three aspects of policing that Sarah Collins plays very much by the book. Lizzie is rather instinctive. And both of them have aspects of those two vital areas of detection, but in different measure. Was it something you felt very much was a struggle between those aspects of detection whilst you were looking into cases?
There are people who have an incredibly good nose. They call it a copper's nose. And the Met has this award every year of Best Thief Taker, which is controversial and some people don't like it. But there was a PC on my ground who was extraordinary how he would bring arrests in. Good arrests, you know, how he would know. And you would look at him and think, how do you know? I used to think he was like an ANPR, a one-man ANPR system, that he must sit on the tube and go ping, ping, ping. So it definitely exists, this instinct. But it needs to be balanced up. And again, I think that comes across in the book where the DCI is much more certain that if somebody's a wrong'un, that they've done the crime.
Mm.
But then again, he's got a point.
And also, it can drag you up blind alleys. It can.
That's right. And people can get fixated on a suspect and they follow that person and follow and put a lot of resources into that person. And we know there are famous cases where this has happened and the other person quietly slips away.
Mm. Which I suppose is why these cold case reviews are so useful, to bring a fresh pair of eyes to a case.
Yes. And of course, technology moves on, and that's the other thing that catches up with some people, is that they didn't realise that they were leaving DNA behind because it hadn't been so prevalent.
And one of the other senses of loss that comes through the book is for a time past, for a time that actually isn't in the so-distant past, 1987, but which represents something, a country where things were done differently, you know,
yes.
where cardboard boxes were rigid and where you had physical photographs.
Yes, and carbon copies of things. And people didn't routinely use computers, and telephone codes were different. And you lived through the time, if you're my age, you were alive during the Great Storm, but the past is a different country. It's, you know, the question of how much we change. And I suppose that's relevant to Sarah Collins in it, because there's a lot of Sarah Collins' backstory in explaining who she is and where she is and what she needs to do in order to become more fully herself.
And there's also the question of how policing has changed in those years. I mean, I was a great fan of The Sweeney, and we've had programmes like Ashes to Ashes on the television, which, you know, show a rougher, tougher police force. And yet the police force of 2014, 2015 in Death Message seem almost constrained by the justice system. It's almost as if they're in a bare-knuckle fight, asking to play by Queensbury rules.
I mean, I think the police themselves talk about pre-PACE, which is a piece of legislation, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, and post-PACE, and they're very different worlds, because there's much more limits now, limits on detention, how long you can keep people in, very strict identification procedures, very strict rules about interviews and what's admissible. And it's a much better world, and the quality of evidence is much better, I think. But I think, yes, of course, that's coupled up with a worry that sometimes the police feel they can't do their jobs. I mean, there's a huge issue at the moment, I think, in London about pursuits, that the police are very frightened and unwilling, and I believe don't very much pursue mopeds anymore. And yet we know that a lot of crime is enabled, serious crime, robbery and so on, is moped enabled. It's very difficult. You've got to care about the people on the bikes and that they don't die, but you've also got to care about the victims of crime. And it's, I think it's very hard to balance up those two things. And in the middle of it, I think police officers get caught up and they don't know how to do their job. They feel damned if they do and damned if they don't, with serious consequences.
But I suppose in that you're also removing the loopholes whereby people can slip out of a conviction.
I think it's really complicated, and I don't have the answers. But I think also another thing that you're having is that there was a time when police could go to an incident and think, it's not really a good idea for these people to get arrested. The best thing is for us to sort it out, get them to say sorry to each other and move on. That was problematic because domestic violence perpetrators weren't arrested and so on, and people who needed to be arrested weren't arrested. But there is another side of the spectrum where sometimes it is better to show discretion, and I think that police are more and more frightened to show discretion, and that perhaps people are arrested and cautioned inappropriately. At the end of the day, society needs to give clearer guidance to police what exactly they want. Because at the same time, they can go on being furious that somebody hasn't been prosecuted for an offence, or outraged that somebody's been arrested for an offence. It's very difficult.
I certainly came away feeling that I had a better view of the police and the job that they did, and realising that the portrayals that we get on television are rather two-dimensional.
The thing that drives me insane is when people think that policing is really simple and why don't people just do it properly? Peter Hitchens is very keen in his columns to say that it's straightforward and that the police should simply do this. It is a difficult job. It is a challenging job. It has all sorts of people working in it. I think that makes for good stories. I think the different kinds of people... I mean, you could say that the DCI in this book... Perhaps you find him unsympathetic, I don't know. But I like him, you know. He's, yes, they call him the bulldozer.
He might not be up to speed. He's definitely pre-pace. And yet there's also something marvellous about him. I mean, the idea that he sings It's Not Unusual at job dues and so on. And he'll back his troops and he likes to get results and he doesn't bear a grudge.
And yet there are other people who are clearly post-pace and do everything by the book and can't see beyond the blinkers, which I suppose, as you said earlier, you need a bag of all sorts.
Yeah, absolutely. You need everybody working together, and if you're lucky, that's what a good team feels like.
Thanks, Kate, and we'll be hearing more from her later in the show. Hot off the press, Death Message is available commercially, and it really is unputdownable.